I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor yourself, please go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. You can sign up to become a Patreon sponsor yourself for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are doing another reading. This time, I'm going to be reading from the book Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait, which was written by George Butler, and it was released in 1990. So I thought after our Pumping Iron reading that we did a couple of weeks ago, this would be another good follow-up, especially since Arnold is in the news so much lately because he's been going around promoting his new book, which is called Be Useful, Seven Tools for Life. So Arnold has really been making the talk show circuit. He's been on a ton of podcasts and TV shows and radio shows. So I've been trying to catch all his interviews. So I thought this would be cool to look back. How long ago was it now? Over 30 years ago since this book came out, and get George Butler's perspective. George, who has now passed away, George Butler's perspective of Arnold from back then. And he goes back to the Pumping Iron book, which he met Arnold in 1973. And then they go into the movie, and then they go into the 1980 Mr. Olympia. So just like the book Pumping Iron, this book also has quotes along the side of the book. So I thought, as I did with the book Pumping Iron, I will read those quotes and maybe read the introduction too. It's a really fascinating book about the real character and the real person of Arnold. And George got to know him very, very well. Plus the photographs in the book, of course, are amazing because George was just a fantastic photographer. So if you never saw this book before, I encourage you to try to find it. You could probably get it on eBay or on Amazon. It's called Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait. And I bought it when it came out in 1990, and it's in perfect condition. It's a hardcover book as well, so that helps out. All right, what else is going on, guys? Mr. Olympia is coming up quick. It's going to be here on the weekend of November 3rd through 5th, I guess. That would be Friday through Sunday. So that'll be next weekend out in Orlando, Florida. I'm going to try and make it out there and try and see it if I can. I'm not going to be working it at all. I'm not going to be working for anybody, but I might be able to get some tickets and go see it, or at least go to the expo. So it should be a really big event. It should be really, really tough competition this year. It's incredible how these guys are looking. Samson Dauda is looking unbelievable. Derek Lunsford. And then you got the reigning champ, Hadi Chupin. He's coming back. So it's really going to be a huge show and very, very tough contest. But as always, as what happens every year, we usually predict, you know, there's like six or seven guys that can win. And then on the day of the show, there's like two or three that are in peak condition. So it never turns out like you think it's going to turn out because those guys have to hit their peak. So it all depends on how many guys hit their peak in order for it to really, really be a good show. But it has potential to be an unbelievable show because some of these guys are looking absolutely amazing. I got to meet one of our Patreon sponsors, a big sponsor of the show, John Hartman. He came into Tampa. Him and his wife were going out on a cruise. So I met him about a week ago. So that was cool. So good to meet John. John is a big sponsor of the show. He's bought a few of my old Iron Man magazines that I was selling. And he is also, as I said, a Patreon sponsor. So it was great to meet him. And I hope he enjoyed his cruise. I also want to give a shout out to Pat Comer, another big supporter of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I actually used to compete with Pat in natural bodybuilding competitions back in 91 and 92 back in Chicago. And I just saw on Facebook that Pat just competed in a show and won. He won the over, well, he's my age, he's 60, and he won the master's division, I guess the over 60 division, and he looked fantastic. So great job, Pat. And Pat was the one that actually gave me the idea for reading this book, Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait, from George Butler. He sent me an email. He's always coming up with ideas, always sending me pictures. So I appreciate that, Pat. I did put a video up on my YouTube channel recently. This was part two of the Steve Brisbois interview that we did a while back, over a year ago. And I had part one up for a while, and I never got part two up. So now I finally got part two up. And I'm trying to get some of these old interviews that I've done. I've still got probably about a dozen of them from over a year ago that they were recorded. They were put up on the podcast. So you guys have heard them, but they were not put up as videos yet. So I'm working right now on the Chris Dickerson tribute. So that goes to show you, because Chris has been passed away for over a year now. So we did a tribute with Boyer Coe and Roy Callender, and also Bill Nealon, who lives out here in Florida. So I'm putting that together now. So that should be up later this week. So if you're on my YouTube channel, check that out. All right. I did get a couple emails. If you guys want to email me, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read your emails on the air. This one comes from Scott from Berlin. And it says, "Hey, John, Arnold is making the rounds on the podcast circuit. He was on Mark Maron's show. I thought it was one of the better Arnold interviews of late. Did you see it? And if so, what did you think? Love your podcast. Keep up the great work." Yes, I did see that one. I thought that was really, really well done. Arnold is just a great interview. And as he's gotten older, he's now 66. I'm sorry, 76, not 66. He's 76. Last year was his 75th birthday. Arnold is very, of course, intellectual now and very introspective. I love his interviews because he's so detailed on everything. He did one interview where he was talking about, I think it might have been this Mark Maron interview, and he was talking about how bodybuilding used to be prejudiced, and he was talking about the AAU, and he mentioned Harold Poole losing the 1963 AAU Mr. America to Vern Weaver, and he remembered all these names. He remembered the dates. He remembered the names. I was blown away by that. I couldn't believe he remembered all that. So yeah, he always tells different stories. Every interview he does is different. So I just think Arnold's a great interviewer. And like I said, as he's gotten older, I guess he's kinder. He's more introspective. He wants to help people. That's the whole basis of this book, is he wanted to inspire people, because he realized that after he got out of the governorship and after he went through his divorce, a lot of people, he was doing motivational speaking, or he was doing speeches places. And then those videos of that were going viral. They're getting over like 2 million views. So then he figured there was a need for people to be motivated by him. So that's why he wrote this book. And the book is very good. I'm like halfway through it now. I bought it myself. Pretty easy read. And he talks a lot about his movie career and just the motivation and how he was able to motivate himself and his bodybuilding career, of course. So it was very interesting. All right, I got another email here. This was a great email. I want to read this one for you guys. He says, "Hey, John, I just heard your interviews with Brian Moss. What an articulate, talented, and insightful man. Indeed, brought back many memories as I worked for the named highly successful Toronto gym owner, Ken Wheeler. Ken took me through my first workout at age 14. I trained with McAway in 83 and 84, and in fact trained Gladys for the 84 Miss Olympia the majority of the time, based on the Gironda Wheeler workouts they had planned. The Bill Dobbins article you read had many errors. Remember, McAway was deep into training for the 84 Olympia in New York, where we all saw Sergio Oliva Jr. get lifted overhead, and the Miss Olympia in Montreal was in late November. Gladys was staying only a couple blocks from the gym in an apartment owned by Wheeler. McAway, on his steak, water, desiccated liver diet, was an absolute nightmare to be around, and thus was in California, or did his own thing. Many mornings I would open the gym and I hear him throwing benches across the room, cursing and ranting. One morning I walked into to work out before the gym opened, and Vince Gironda was training alone in a string tank top and knitted, like grandma would knit, track pants. I had been warned and I said nothing to Gironda, and I went about training chest. After about 15 minutes of silence, Gironda walked over and said, 'I heard about you. Are you training neck or ass? Because with what you're doing, you are most certainly not training chest.' So was the start of many conversations and breakfast with Vince. Gladys trained very hard. Gironda sissy squats until the cows came home, hack squats, assisted chins and dips, etc. All the stuff Gironda was known for, and for endless sets. She slept, ate, and trained. In fact, one night she was so fed up with being isolated, I picked her up and we went out for a big steak, and we saw the premiere of Conan the Destroyer. I remember her gushing that Mike Christian had just won the heavyweight universe in Las Vegas over Barry DeMay, and she was elated for him. The film, not so much. McAway returned devastated from New York. Remember, Haney had never beaten him before. But with the return of carbs, was at least tolerable. We pummeled Gladys in the gym for the next few weeks, and then we all left for Montreal. Funny anecdote, Geronda shows up in a huge white turtleneck and a brown buckskin jacket with fringes, looking like Wild Bill. It's about 65 degrees out, and we are all in t-shirts. I smiled as everywhere Geronda went, it was the same pick. One hand on his hip and the other on his side with that lat flared. So typical, so Geronda. Indeed, Bob Kennedy would adopt this pose also for his picks. Bob was photographing and around us constantly with Geno Edwards, remembering Muscle Mag was based in Toronto. Macaway lightened up even more after I got a few beers in him the night before the show, and we visited many hotel rooms with friends, including judges Jacques and Julian Blumhardt and Samir Banoot, who was competing in the Grand Prix. He was also devastated by the IFBB injustice as the reigning champ at the 84 Mr. Olympia weeks earlier. At the very least, Macaway had retained his runner-up position. Samir had fallen off the mountain, but that's a whole other conversation. The team, Wheeler, Kennedy, Geronda, were absolutely livid when Gladys came out on stage at prejudging with her hair slicked back tight against her head. She had done it to make her look wider. Her famous mane was not on display, and her femininity diminished, competing against none other than Rachel McDish. The best of memories and endless stories. Thanks for all you document, John. David Bunda. Wow. Was that a great email or what? That was awesome. I should get David on the show so he could tell us more of those stories for being there. That was awesome. All right. Well, like I said, if you guys got any emails for me, please send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. I'm going to open up this book now. Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait, written by George Butler, and it was published by Simon & Schuster in 1990. So I want to read, there's really no chapters. It kind of just goes in one big chapter, but there is an introduction, and I thought this would be cool to read. This was a really cool introduction. It says, he seems to float, suspending himself palms down on the rails of two back-to-back chairs. There are seven other men in the photograph, but they fall away anonymously in his presence. His upper body, trapezius flexed, deltoids rolled forward, abdomen vacuumed into a small shadow, is an accumulation of striking details. The pectoral muscles beneath are large and sweeping. They glisten so shockingly in the air of the shabby room that the figure who bears them seems neither man nor woman to my awakening eye. Looking at this uncertain photograph today, I can see strange contradictory images. His left arm lit and contoured as if it were the head of a carved ivory elephant, his own face tilting down to the right, eyes closed, a fragile death mask with life we know to come. All the hubris, which we were to see much of later, curiously absent. I took this picture 18 years ago on September 16th, 1972, in a backstage room at a bodybuilding contest in Brooklyn, New York, on the day I met Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was the earliest print I made of him in my dark room, and it was published shortly after in the Village Voice. Its publication, I suppose, signaled the coming of Muhammad, the vanguard of the national media, to the mountain. The mountain himself, with an ego that was slightly bigger than the Austrian Alps, was ready to receive them, then and now. A lot of what I did for the next 10 years was to be the interpreter between Arnold and the press. This was essential, as well as unusual for a photographer-filmmaker, for without the highly successful publicity campaigns for the book Pumping Iron and the movie that followed, neither would have been funded or released. But these were, as well, rich and fulfilling years for me as an artist. And out of those years came an extraordinary friendship. There was also a less obvious aspect to him that I hope my camera captures in this book. He had an almost complete control over his body. It was an extraordinary thing to witness. For instance, when we gave the evening of bodybuilding at the Whitney Museum in 1976, when Arnold appeared as the subject of the best intended and perhaps most far out event in the history of the museum, I asked him to trim down and appear as slender and unimposing as possible. He promptly lost 30 pounds of muscle in less than 3 weeks. On other occasions, he simply reversed the procedure. "How did you do this?" I asked. "It's all in the mind," he replied. "You have to will the body to change." I watched such changes, and then I watched him change in other ways, and change again. By the time we were through, our working relationship on the subject of bodybuilding ended in 1982-83, I had watched Arnold reinvent himself several times. In the beginning, he was an awkward bodybuilder in the dark subculture that America wanted no part of. At the end, he was an international star ready to become the richest man in California and eventually the highest paid movie actor in history. This book is about his passage as a bodybuilder. It shows how he took his body and used it to achieve the American dream. It was my good luck to find him that night in Brooklyn and to travel with him as a friend and observer along the way. And then there's another chapter here called The Presentation. So I want to read this as well. This is only a couple pages. It says, noticing where the best light falls, I place four leather boxes of pictures in a mounted 11 by 14 mats on a massive oak desk. I open the first box and an impatient Arnold Schwarzenegger begins to look at the photographs in this book. I am confident he will be pleased. I have worked hard and meticulously in my dark room with the kind of professionalism Arnold always respects. Now he will see the results of 10 years effort, 100 photographs of himself, many of which I have just printed for the first time. As he looks at the images in chronological order, beginning when I met him in 1972, his hands tremble. I'm very surprised to notice this, and I walk to the far side of his desk, hoping he will shake it off. But his hands continue to tremble. I sit on a chair, and I try to avoid looking at him. He's always been fascinated by my pictures and films. What is going through his mind? It's a Friday afternoon. A month earlier, I called him from the East about these pictures. You don't need to schedule a meeting, he said generously. Phone me when you get here. I'll look at them right away. I had arrived the previous Sunday at the Shangri-La Hotel in Santa Monica. I called. It took all week to get in to see him. And now, as his secretaries make clear, he's trying to leave for Palm Springs. Within 10 minutes, he has skimmed through all the photographs in a way that fails to disguise the intensity in his eyes. Then he leans back and utters a strange but revealing statement. George, he says, folding his hands and pressing them, knuckles toward me, on the edge of the desk. I will tell you something. Something I have learned. A man who gets rich finally becomes what he is. These pictures are from when I was becoming rich. Why don't you stop this sort of thing and make some money? And then we will know who you really are. He smiles, not unkindly, and gives me a mercurial gaze. I notice it's the same less than true look he's given many of these photographs as he sped through them. These photographs, you know, he points at one of the last pictures in this collection. It shows him alone on stage at the Sydney Opera House. These photos are not me. Well, as we both know, a camera can't lie. That was you at the moment, I suggest, in what I hope is a helpful tone. But there's no pump, no monster arms. I look tiny. That picture's an exception. It's an in-between poses. I look at it upside down on his desk. It's a fine picture. You look ascendant. Come on, he guffaws. I am not ascendant, whatever that may mean. I try again. It's still a wonderful story, these pictures. It catches you on the pivot of your life, the 10 years that you took from being an unknown to becoming a superstar. And furthermore, these pictures and the movie Pumping Iron sort of, well, made it all possible. Arnold's phone rings. He seizes it. Tell Maria I will be there very soon. Very soon, I said. He hangs up and looks at me. I'd like to publish these pictures as a book, I say quietly, meeting his eyes. And Cornell Coppa has offered me an exhibition at the International Center of Photography in New York. I want to do these things with you the way we always have. I hope you'll collaborate. You can write an introduction. I'm willing to go to great lengths to please you. It's not just my story about you. It's your story. An unusual story about our time in America. It reminds me of what Alex Haley did when he wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X. I should know better than to compare this work to the form and structure of that book, even though it is one I've always admired. It is not the most convincing example to pick in the age of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, especially in the company of their strongest supporter. Now I find myself facing down the brow of a confused and suspicious Austrian oak. But I'm wrong. It is not Malcolm X that is bothering him the most. It is, of course, the bottom line. I plan my own autobiography, thank you. Swifty Lazar, you know? He hesitates and peers at me. I nod to show that I know the agent in question. What Arnold did not know was that Lazar once rejected my proposal for a movie called Pumping Iron about an unknown Austrian with the name Schwarzenegger. But that was in another country, home of the Cannes Film Festival. At the time, 1975, I was trying to finance the film against staggering resistance. As I remember this, Arnold is inevitably moving the conversation onto his own turf, his own new turf, which he is beginning to control as well as anyone in Hollywood. I hear him energetically getting caught up in a deal. In this case, like a great mogul, he even supplies both sides of the conversation. I will get you $1 million in advance, Swifty says. I say, no, I want $5 million. Swifty says, that's the biggest book deal in history, he says. Arnold, are you crazy? I say, what do you expect, Swifty? You're the hustler. Then Arnold, who is now speaking about himself, does another movie in 3 months. 10 weeks on the set, bang, $12 million plus 6% of the gross. Arnold establishes more value for Arnold. This allows Arnold to tell Swifty he has to pay $10 million, making it twice as big as the biggest book deal in history. But already it's too late again, because now Arnold wants $20 million for his autobiography. Amazing, Arnold says, shaking his head with the most complete satisfaction. Well, that's also a totally different book. Let this wet his chops, I reply. I was certain now and forever that all sense of traditionally lean, understated, parsimonious New England values ended west of the Connecticut River on the border between my New Hampshire and that yuppie state, Vermont. No, George, it gets in the way. I'm not ready yet. You remember, and he pronounces these words very carefully, the master plan. We both laugh completely and easily. I haven't heard him mention the master plan in years. Somehow I had assumed with his vast success that the master plan had been realized and discontinued, that Arnold's life was already in excess of any boy's dream. I am, of course, wrong again. Guilty of making another assumption about Arnold. The master plan is still in place, purring as timelessly as the gold Rolex Oyster Perpetual on his wrist. I start to remember the day in 1977 when we walked into Rolex on Fifth Avenue in New York, and he charmed them into giving him the watch. As I think about that time, my friend blinks. He puts his big index fingers with the chewed down fingernails to his eyelids and gently presses them. In the moment of his darkness, I can see him watching his life arc toward the 21st century. I look carefully at his face as he solemnly rubs his eyes. Sitting across from me at his massive oak desk is the same man I met in 1972. But there have been some changes in the years between. It just wasn't always quite like this. All right. That was great. Okay, so then the book starts, and it starts with Pumping Iron. And I'm going to start reading some of these. I have some great pictures in here of Arnold with his girlfriend, Barbara Outland, taken in their apartment, which I did not realize George took. And then the picture of Arnold in Santa Monica College studying. And then the picture where they met, which was Bruno Sammartino, Franco, and Arnold sitting there judging the 1972 Mr. America. It says, at the Brooklyn Academy of Music during the pre-judging of the Mr. America contest 1972, Bruno Sammartino, world champion professional wrestler, Franco Colombo, and Arnold sit in the foreground. And then they have some pictures here that were in the original Pumping Iron. And then they show Arnold squatting, and it says squats. The white moment is the instant a weightlifter steps forward to pick up the weight. It says squat. This is the one he's squatting with Denny Gable. The barbell holds over 500 pounds. In just one part of a morning routine, Arnold would complete 10 sets of 12 repetitions for an aggregate of 60,000 pounds. He's wrong on that, by the way. This is, let's see, 315... It's like 365, 75, looks like 405. He's got three plates, a 25 and two 10s, so that's 405. And then they show a couple pictures of Arnold posing backstage, and it says right bicep. He had the ability to isolate his muscles. There are two heads to the bicep, for instance. Arnold would determine to the centimeter exactly how big he wanted each muscle to be. He saw himself quite objectively as a collection of so many parts. What you see in this picture is the quiet pride in his eyes as they look down on a cultivated piece of territory. And then there's a quote here from Arnold where he says, my relationship to power and authority is that I'm all for it. People need somebody to watch over them and tell them what to do. 95% of the people in the world need to be told what to do and how to behave. And then they got some more great pictures of Pumping Iron, the book, of him training. And then it says wrist curls. And this looks like a picture from 1980. It says, once I heard the great Connecticut bodybuilder Mike Katz say to Arnold as they were seated side by side on Roman chair working their abdominals, I hate these quiet, boring exercises we have to do. Arnold replied, you may get bored, Mike. I use these exercises to think. I use every minute to plan where I make my next dollar. That way I am never bored. And then it says, Gold's Gym was on Ocean Boulevard in Venice. In the early 70s, a lot of far-out people wandered its length. They were worldly characters, and many of them thought they'd seen just about everything. A few even wandered into the gym. Arnold would spot them staring at him and ask Franco to hand him another 5,000-pound plate. And then they got a picture of Arnold doing donkey calf raises with Denny Gable and Kent Keene on his back. And it says, donkey calf raises. I once saw a competitive bodybuilder standing in front of a mirror in the gym. He was concentrating as he flexed his muscles and admiring what was in front of him, betraying the very uncompetitive sin of self-love. Arnold, on his way into the gym, paused to look at the younger man. You're fat, he said in a flat, objective voice. No way, said the bodybuilder indignantly. He reached under his arm and pinched at his obliques. It's all muscle. I broke my water table last Tuesday. No fat, and I'm not retaining water. Arnold shrugged and ambled toward the changing room in his thong slippers. He started up the stairs. How can you tell where the fat is? Implored the younger man, following him. Arnold paused at the balcony. Everyone at the gym was now watching. Jump up and down. The bodybuilder did as he was told. See, you're fat. Your waist is jiggling, Arnold said, grinning. You mean, yes, it's simple, Arnold said. If it jiggles, it's fat. It was a pretty clear definition of America's preoccupation, I thought. And then they got another one here. It said that there is a bodybuilder who lives in California who spent his life dreaming about becoming Mr. Olympia. He was a giant in his time, tall, handsome, and genetically perfect. He trained like a demon. College educated, he learned more about nutrition than any other bodybuilder. He had patrons who provided him financial freedom so he could train full time. They advised him on his business affairs and he became wealthy. At the peak of his career, in the best shape of his life, he competed against Arnold Schwarzenegger once. Not only did he lose, but he was broken by the experience. Soon after, he lost his money, his wife, and his looks. He became prematurely old. Today, he wanders on the streets of Los Angeles, incoherent and homeless. Arnold did not want this to happen, but it did. Such was his power over his competitors, who dreamed they could beat him. And that obviously was supposed to be Mike Mentzer, I believe. And then there's a quote here from Arnold. He says, I think the public thinks I am narcissistic because I look in the mirror. What they don't understand is that is the only way I can check my progress. How do I know that my muscles grow the way I want? By flexing them and checking them in the mirror, by measuring them with a tape, or possibly by stepping on the scale. The mirror is by far the best because I can see each muscle's definition. That is very subtle. Sometimes even another bodybuilder cannot see what I can. A swimmer uses a stopwatch like a mirror. A jumper's tape is his mirror. But the public is weirdly afraid of themselves. They are guilty about the mirror. They think by looking in it, there's something wrong. How many mirrors are there in America? And then they got a couple pictures of Arnold here doing press behind the neck. And he said, George says, what makes the sport so cinematic is that cameras can always come in close on a bodybuilder's face while he's training. In other sports, athletes move at a dizzying pace that the camera cannot follow coherently. And he says, in the early days, when I photographed Arnold before he had acted in movies, his facial expressions were natural. After he had been to an acting coach, I began to notice that he was thinking about his expressions. The movie Pumping Iron was made before this change occurred. I doubt he will ever have that natural expressiveness again that we captured in the film. And then they have a picture of Arnold and Charles Gaines looking at pictures of himself, I believe. And it says, Charles Gaines also wrote a novel called Stay Hungry. It was a fine first novel and it was nominated for a National Book Award. After our book, Pumping Iron, was published, it drew the attention of director Bob Rafelson to bodybuilding. He adapted Stay Hungry to the screen in a movie starring Jeff Bridges and Sally Field. It also introduced a new actor named Arnold Schwarzenegger playing the part of a bodybuilder named Joe Santo. Santo, like Arnold, crossed social lines and did everything well, including fiddling in a country band. Upon getting to know Arnold, we were struck by the curious similarities between him and the fictional character he was to play in the movie. It was almost as if Charles Gaines had created an Arnold in fiction before we met him in fact. Here, Arnold is approving a photo of himself. Charles Gaines looks over his shoulder. And then they got pictures on the beach in Venice, and it says, Venice Beach. When he was in training for a contest, as he was here, he would train for 3 hours in the morning, have lunch, and hit the beach, or at least the grassy area near the beach. Then he would sleep in the sand, efficiently tanning himself with subconscious adjustments to the angle of its beam. He always woke up slowly and grumpily. When his energy returned, which it always did with a rush, he would become once again the center of attention, king of the beach. And then it says, in a scene in Pumping Iron, Arnold is asleep on the beach and then is awoken to be reminded that he should be training for a contest. I found a rising starlet to wake the oak. She had been aggressively tanning nearby and looked like she wanted to be filmed. As the camera was placed on the tripod, she blanched. "Are you shooting this in 16 millimeter?" she asked. "Yes," said the assistant cameraman. She stood up, looking peculiar. "Well," she said, "I only do 35 millimeter." With that, she wandered away. What she didn't understand was that we were using a blow-up process that converts to 35 millimeter. Eddie Giuliani stood in for the starlet and made it one of the funniest scenes of the movie. And then they show Arnold at the 74 Olympian. It says Arnold winning his fifth world professional championship. That afternoon, while he was sitting quietly in the audience watching other contestants in the prejudging, a man muttering loudly tried to barge across a line of seats toward him. A ruckus ensued, and armed police escorted the stranger out into the streets. Watching this from the front of the auditorium, I knew that Arnold, who lusted for fame and glory, must now pay its price. I thought the man was crazy and dangerous. Arnold must have, too. He looked very sober after this occurred. Finally, he slipped away. I found him later in his hotel, quietly eating carrot cake. And then they got some great shots of Arnold posing in South Africa with those three young black children. And it says, in Cape Town, I spent a morning at the beach photographing Arnold being photographed by Annie Leibovitz of Rolling Stone magazine. She set up this photo with some young South Africans who were clearly fascinated by the specter of the once again world champion. And then there's a quote of Arnold here. It says, my definition of a sport is that it's a physical activity that involves competition. Since bodybuilders certainly train and then compete, we are certainly a sport. The unique thing about bodybuilding is that when I compete, it's just me on the stage alone. There is no field, no bat, no ball, no skis, no skates. All of the athletes have to use equipment, like a football. As soon as the football is thrown, where does the eye go? To the football. But I don't use anything in competition except myself. It's just me up there, me alone. No coach, no nothing. And then they got a quote here from Vicki Goldberg, who was a moderator at the Whitney Museum Symposium that they did in 76. And she says, all right, we're talking about a subject which is fascinating and quite present before our eyes, but which is rarely discussed in a public forum. That is to say, the representation of a muscular body in art. This evening, we will also see the highly specialized type of body in action, that of the professional bodybuilder. Pumping Iron is subtitled The Art and Sport of Bodybuilding, which instantly raises the question for us of whether bodybuilding is indeed art. And then there's a quote here from Colin Eisler, who says, Michelangelo's Neoplatonic concept of sculpture, bringing form out of the block, is somewhat analogous to the process of formal self-realization through bodybuilding that we have seen before us, in which exercise brings out a fresh manifestation of the divine original within. And then Arnold says, I'm actually in heaven being here tonight and having it happen the way it never happened before. People are ashamed of looking at the body, and it's time to change that. And then here it says, sometimes even a good friend can be a rascal. I'm sure I've taken advantage of my friendship with Arnold as he has with me. One anecdote that doesn't wash in Arnold's repertory for his press interviews has to do with his very earliest days in America. According to Arnold, he and Franco earned their living when they first arrived in Los Angeles with a bricklaying business, which is true. We called our company Pumping Bricks, Arnold has been quoted as saying, which is untrue. The fact of the matter is that Charles Gaines invented the term pumping iron in late 1974 as the title for our book. The term describes the sport beautifully. I don't believe Arnold when he claims to have used the phrase pumping bricks 5 or 6 years earlier. But it's very flattering to the authors of the book Pumping Iron that their world-famous subject would want to claim a prior ownership of its valuable form. And then George has got a bunch of pictures here of him and Arnold when they were on their way to the Cannes Film Festival in 1977 to promote the movie Pumping Iron. And this picture is taken before the Rhine River. And it says, before going to the Cannes Film Festival with the movie in 1977, Arnold invited me to visit Austria and Germany. On this May afternoon, we were traveling with friends from Vienna to Munich, where Arnold lived before he coming to America. Germany is the second of his three countries. And then it says, in Vienna, we ate some incredible meals. Then we toured the cafes and ate Viennese pastry and strudel until I thought all of us would become sick. Isn't this excessive? I asked Arnold. Of course, he replied. We are fooling the body again. Yeah? The body's very lazy. It gets into a routine. It does what it thinks it's supposed to do. So just when the body thinks that it can metabolize my high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet, I plunder it. Suddenly, the body must work again. What is this sarcha torte that has arrived for breakfast. Now the body must think instantly and be ready for the next ambush. For example, when I return to Santa Monica and Ken Waller brings a 20-gallon drum of ice cream to my house at 2 a.m. A few years later, Arnold was visiting the East and he joined me on a morning run. He noticed I was doing the same stretching exercises I always do before loping off into the mist. Fool the body, he said, like this. He showed me a number of new stretching exercises. Do you ever run backwards, I asked, just to fool the body? Of course, he said. And then there's a quote here from Arnold. He says, I am a Leo. If you believe this kind of thing, then you find out that Leos are more aggressive people than other people, and they are more physical than any others. I believe in this a little bit. Not everything, but a little bit. Because when I read what the lion is supposed to be and I check what I am, it's exactly the same thing. So that's why I believe in it. And then they got some really good pictures of Arnold with his mother in Austria. And then there's a quote here. It says, I believe this is from Pumping Iron. He says, if you want to be a champion, you can't have any kind of outside negative force coming in to affect you. So I trained myself for that, to be totally cold and not have things going through my mind. And it was a sad story when my father died because my mother called me on the phone and she said, you know, your dad died. And this was exactly 2 months before a contest. Are you coming home for the funeral? I said, no, it's too late. He's dead and nothing can be done. I'm sorry, I can't come. And I didn't explain the reasons why, because how do you explain to a mother whose husband died, you just can't be bothered now because of the contest? And then George says, the statement of Arnold's in the film Pumping Iron caused more controversy than any other part of his role in the movie. It is not literally true, but it is a fable. It tells more about Arnold than his true reaction to his father's death. What happened was this. I once told Arnold about a boxer at the Olympics. He had worked his way through the preliminary rounds to the finals for the gold medal when he learned of his father's death. He then had to make a decision. Should he go home to the funeral or should he box for the medal? He decided to fight. When he won the gold medal, he dedicated the medal to his mother and was widely applauded for his decision. Arnold loved this story. That's exactly what I would do, George. Furthermore, my father would want me to do that, and my mother would understand completely. At the time of the on-camera interview in Pumping Iron, Arnold used the story of the boxer to personify himself. It perfectly fitted his philosophy, and it explained to the movie audience in a vivid example exactly what was required of a champion. Arnold was so convincing when he told this story that I began to wonder if it was not actually the truth. I checked up. And Arnold said, what actually happened at the time of my father's death, he said, was that I was at a contest in Mexico giving an exhibition. Then I split for a vacation. No one could reach me, even by phone. When I arrived in Los Angeles, Franco Colombo met me at the airport and he told me that my father had died and had been buried. I immediately took the next flight to Austria to comfort my mother. As the creative control of the film was in my hands, I made the decision to use Arnold's fable. Even though it was not the literal truth, it was a powerful way of conveying the truth about Arnold. It tells so much about Arnold now as it did then. And then they have a picture of Arnold with his mother, Aurelia. And it says, when Arnold was growing up in Austria, he spent a lot of time reading muscle magazines and watching Hercules movies starring Steve Reeves and Reg Park. This was an endless series in those days. Hercules Unchained, Hercules and the Captive Women, Hercules Against the Sons of the Sun, Hercules Against the Moon Men, Hercules Against Rome, and on and on. When he arrived in America, Joe Weider had a bright idea to get Arnold into a Hercules movie. It was called Hercules Goes Bananas, not a title that might endear Arnold to his future press agents. The movie was released here and there in the early 1970s with a new title, Hercules in New York. It says, Arnold is a devoted son. His veneer melts the moment he is with his mother. This big man behaves almost like a puppy in her presence. I'm always touched by his sincerity and her grateful response. The losses of his father and his only brother in an automobile accident appear to have greatly tightened his bond with her. And then Arnold has a quote here. It says, my upbringing contributed a lot to my success. My father was a police officer and wanted his family to be the perfect example to the town. We couldn't do anything bad. He was very strict, checking out everything. If we were clean, if our shoes were brushed. I was brought up under great discipline, which meant that when I made up my mind, I had to follow through. I had a master plan from the moment I arrived in America. That's still in me. Every year I set a goal to win the Mr. Olympia or to get so many units in business school, to make a certain amount of money, to travel to 5 or 6 different countries. Every year I make a plan. I do it. It will be done. As a child, Arnold determined from seeing movies and reading comic books and muscle magazines that he would become a bodybuilder. Reg Park, one of the great bodybuilders of the time, was his idol. In the beginning, as a young teenager, Arnold did not even have a set of weights at home. Here he shows me how he did isometric exercises with whatever equipment was possible. And then there's a picture here of Arnold and a young child and his mother. And it says Arnold with his mother and Hildegard Horischunz. After I took this picture, Hildegard, who was a cousin of Arnold's, came and drew a picture of the house with a smoking chimney and a notebook and signed her name beneath it. She was very shy around Arnold and just old enough to appreciate him as a famous man who had come home from America to visit her village of Thal. She asked me to give this to my son, Desmond, who was her age and was born 4 days after I met Arnold. And then they got the pictures from the Cannes Film Festival. It says, after leaving Austria, we went to France where Pumping Iron was opening at the Cannes Film Festival. The distributors got us involved with a zany French count. It was his inspiration to bring all the girls from Crazy Horse, the famous nightclub in Paris, down to the beach next to the Croissant. There, he outfitted them in long dresses and summer hats. Arnold would then somehow contrast his body with theirs. He did. 50,000 people, mostly with cameras, surrounded Arnold and his flowery backdrops. And then they got some pictures here, really close-up pictures of Arnold flexing his calf. And I know there's all rumors about Arnold having calf implants, but I can tell you, looking at these pictures, I really don't think he ever had calf implants. There's no scars anywhere. And the muscle looks totally normal with veins going through it and bumps in the muscle. So it definitely looks like a real muscle, a real calf. And then they show the photo of the poster of Pumping Iron and also the cover of the book Pumping Iron with Ed Corney on it. And it says, actually, the photo on the poster is not Arnold. It is Ed Corney, a 43-year-old Mr. Universe who plays a large part in the book Pumping Iron. This is also the picture we used on the cover. Arnold badly wanted to have an image of himself on the movie poster. I avoided this. Arnold, I said, I do not want this movie to appear only as a vehicle for your career. I think this film should be about how you elevated the whole sport. Let's use this picture of Ed. It also has just the right feeling of elation. Arnold listened and agreed. For several years in New York, a newspaper called the Soho Weekly News appeared on the scene, taking some precise shots at hip downtown culture and acting as an ombudsman of the avant-garde. After Arnold made his initial impact, they wrote about him scathingly, calling him a dork and the quickest flash-in-the-pan celebrity in history. In fact, they suggested he personified Andy Warhol's idea that the dawning age would produce 15-minute celebrities who immediately became anonymous. I remember being annoyed by this article when it appeared. I think Arnold was quite hurt. A few weeks later, the Soho Weekly News folded. And it says, some writers stay with friends or book themselves into motels. Arnold, the writer, only traveled first class, and he only stayed in deluxe hotel suites. Soon he would be traveling on private planes. And then Arnold says, what I'm doing is the thing I want to do. I don't care what other people think. If the rest of the world disagrees and says I shouldn't waste my time, I still will be a bodybuilder. I love it. I love the feeling of my muscles. I love the competition. And I love the things it gives me. I have never really had a work in my whole life. I've never had an 8-to-6 job. I've always made good money. I traveled all over the world competing and giving exhibitions. I've made a profession out of a pastime, which perhaps only 5% of the population can do. The other 95% are frustrated office workers working for someone else. I'm totally independent. So I feel if I would live again or if I would be born again, I would do exactly the same thing. And then George says, bodybuilders always made a fuss about being photographed with harsh, elaborate lighting in expensive studios. Almost all the magazine work that was done with Arnold was abrupt and tasteless. I found that sunlight gave his body a power that exceeded all the bad photography he seemed to covet. And then Arnold's quote here, not many people understand what a pump is. It must be experienced to be understood. It is the greatest feeling I get. I search for this pump because it means that my muscles will grow when I get it. I get a pump when the blood is running into my muscles. They really become tight with blood, like the skin is going to explode any minute. It's like someone putting air in my muscles. It blows up. It feels fantastic. So some of these quotes were obviously from Pumping Iron, but they didn't use the whole quote. And then here's another story. It says, one day I heard a knock on my door. It was a young man looking like a muscular Huckleberry Finn. He was holding a copy of Pumping Iron. Good afternoon, he said. I'm Bill Bixby, and I hear Arnold sometimes stays on this farm. I nodded. Do you need some help haying? I like heavy bales, and I'm good at taking care of animals. Bill got himself a job. But since he hitchhiked over from Wentworth, New Hampshire every morning, he left his copy of Pumping Iron with me. I thought Arnold might possibly drop in some evening on his way to New York or Europe. He wanted to make sure the Oaks signed it under any circumstance. A few weeks later, I told Bill that Arnold and Maria were coming for the weekend. At 7 a.m. that Saturday morning, Arnold and I were sleepily lacing our running shoes on the front porch when we heard loud cheering and clapping from the direction of the bar. Most uncommon, I thought. We stood up and saw Bill with all the top bodybuilders in the state waiting to meet their hero. A line of cars stretched down the road and disappeared into the maple trees. "Have you still got my book?" Bill hollered happily. All right. I think then he goes into the 1980 Olympia where George was at, and they got some pictures of Arnold posing for those old ladies on the park bench. And then they got some pictures of Arnold with Dan Howard in the gym where it says Mensur is coming in the background. And it says, by the time Arnold went back to competition in Sydney, Australia, the world of bodybuilding had changed. In 1972, there were only a handful of gyms in New York. Now there were hundreds, and they had opened across America in the tens of thousands. When we began the book, we estimated there might possibly be 100,000 bodybuilders in America. Now there were 40 million. And bodybuilding had become more popular than jogging. It was a veritable cultural revolution called Pumping Iron. And then they have some pictures of Arnold working out at World's Gym in 1980 that George took. And it says, under the 500-pound bar again, no matter how coyly Arnold approached his return to competition, there was a look in his eye that told me he was worried about the risk. Could he force his body to do again what it had always done so well before after five follow years? And of course, Arnold was not sweating 500 pounds in 1980. I think he was doing more like 225 in the Smith machine. And then it says, by now, even Arnold's muscles had changed. When I met him, they were raw and soft. Now they were like stainless steel, refined, worked at, and stretched like musical instruments. And then they have a picture of Arnold and Maria on the plane going to Australia. This is a great picture. And it says, Arnold and Maria en route to Sydney, Australia. In 1980, Maria was Arnold's secret weapon. She became totally involved in the contest, learning everything she could about Arnold's complex sport. In Sydney, she was the most present partner of a competitor I've ever seen. When he competed in the Opera House, I could hear her voice above the whole frenzied audience. Arnold, Arnold, Arnold. Yeah, I've got Wayne Galash's tape from GMV of the prejudging, and you can hear Maria's voice in that video. And then they got the picture of Arnold and Joe Gold hugging. And he says, embracing his old friend, Joe Gold, a man of striking presence and character, Joe paid Arnold the compliment of coming to Australia to lend his support. And then they have a picture of him backstage doing that side chest pose. And it says, backstage, check posing. The enormous strain of the forced comeback shows on Arnold's face. The charming, boyish Austrian I met in 1972, who did everything with such ingenuous curiosity and joy, my friend, had given way to a more severe, calculating champion. And then there's a quote here from Arnold. He says, I can hide my feelings under my muscles. Definitely. I can hide them as long as necessary. And when I feel they can come out, I let them out. I think this is fantastic. It's great to have control over my mind. Other people get mixed up. They can't control themselves. They can't go to work for a week, or they can't talk on the phone because they're crying. I can switch myself back and forth. When I'm training for a competition, I can be what some people call inhuman. But really, I think it's more like being superhuman. Then after the competition, I can switch off and again be a human and be very emotional and so on. And then they have a great picture from behind the stage of the top seven bodybuilders doing the pose down. They have Dickerson, Zane, Mensur, Callender, Roger Walker, Arnold, and Boyer Coe. And it says, in the middle of the competition, Franco Colombo, who was acting as Arnold's manager, noticed that the lighting in the Opera House was uneven. The best light was on the left, whereas Arnold was on the darker right side. In a contest, good lighting can be crucial. Franco began yelling to Arnold to move, but in the pandemonium, Arnold could not hear. So Franco leapt up on stage. He spoke quickly to Arnold in German, drawing the attention of the other competitors. As they started to protest, Arnold stepped off the posing platform, seized Franco's arm, and raised it in the air as if to introduce the champion to the crowd. They gave Franco a standing ovation. While this cheering continued, Arnold elbowed his way back into the lineup on the left side of the platform and resumed posing in the best lit position of all. This interruption rattled the other competitors. What were Arnold and Franco discussing in German? I could see the confusion on their faces as they looked angrily toward Arnold. As they did so, the contest began swinging in Arnold's favor. The other competitors had just lost their concentration. Some had even lost their pump. Meanwhile, Franco leapt off stage into the front row, where he continued yelling until Arnold was declared the winner. Yeah, I know that really pissed off a lot of the competitors when Franco did that. Another psychological advantage Arnold had over his rivals was the swiftness with which he got in shape for the contest. By the time he arrived in Sydney and began acting like a champion, ready to compete, he actually looked like a champion. How could anyone get in shape so quickly? It was almost a superhuman accomplishment. And who wanted to compete with a superhuman? And then there's a quote here from Arnold where he says, "A lot of things come through my mind while I'm posing. When I pose, a very good pose, let's say the most muscular pose, the audience starts screaming. In my mind, I say to them, kind of like, well, here it is. Here is the best body. Look at it and just freak out, because you're only going to see one of them. That's it. I let them know that what they get is mind-blowing. They are not going to get it tomorrow, not the next day, maybe never again. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, especially since my career as a bodybuilder is almost over. I just hope they appreciate my body." Obviously, they do. I hear the applause. And then one of the last pictures of the book is that picture that Arnold was talking about in the intro, where he's standing on stage. You can see the whole audience of the Sydney Opera House, and Arnold's back is to the audience, but George is backstage. He's behind the stage, so he's taking a picture of Arnold, and he looks very, very thin. I could see what Arnold was talking about. His arms are down. Looks like he's coming up into a rear double bicep, but Arnold looks very, very thin. And says, "Arnold is an example of the precise man. When he worked in the gym, every single exercise was performed with a mathematical grace. Every motion counted. The grasp on the bar, the lift, the inhale at the moment of force, the exhale at the peak of the lift, the arc of the weight above the body, or sometimes below. Most bodybuilders get tired and sloppy. Not Arnold. He would actually pause before each set as his mind projected the motions he would require. I never saw him cheat a motion. He never left the gym early. At the time we worked together, I observed this iron discipline in all aspects of his personal life. If he bought a car, he had a new telephone installed or fixed the roof of his condominium. He did each chore with the same sense of efficiency. Being around him was instructive to me. Arnold's drive for perfection taught me a lot about my own life, and I changed it accordingly. The way in which I approach the details of my life, the system of getting things done, has been influenced by what I learned from observing Arnold." And then it says, "There's a book called Zen and the Art of Archery, which was given to me by Enrico Natale. Enrico is a photographer who taught me most about what I know about the craft I practice. As I was admiring his present, he reminded me, 'George, if you can learn to get yourself out of your pictures, they'll be good ones. This book will tell a similar thing about archery. Shut your eyes as you aim for the bullseye.' This particular photograph may be the best picture I've taken of Arnold. It is certainly one of the most widely sought after. I took it with one hand as I was following Arnold down through some boulders to the beach below. As he leaned against a big boulder to support himself, his back muscles caught the sunlight in a moment in which he was actually using them. By luck, I snapped my shutter at that instant." Yeah, this is an amazing photo of Arnold, as he said, walking down, and he's got both hands on the wall. It looks like he's pushing the wall, but he was just steadying himself as he was going down toward the beach. And I mentioned this picture when I talked to Brian Moss in our interview. Okay, and then I want to read this last part of the book, which is called The Presentation Continued. So this is a continuation of what I read in the beginning of the book. "Arnold, back from projecting his master plan into the 21st century, has stopped rubbing his eyes. They are wide open, peering across his desk as I suggest an alternative way for him to consider this book. Well, why don't you think of this as just a book that covers 10 years of real friendship? My life and your life when I was around with my camera and later with my camera crew making this master plan possible. You know, the years when we were having fun together." "George," he says, reverting to a strong Austrian accent, "these pictures are not really me." "But they are, Arnold, and they're me as well. Both of us did them," I say forcefully. "Put yourself in my position. I have a lot of time and good work in your career, traveling around the world, banging down the brick walls you faced. Would you deny me those 10 years when I do my memoirs? I mean, this is my autobiography as well as yours." Arnold reaches for an inlaid humidor. He takes out two Churchill-sized cigars. He hands one to me, ignoring the question. No, thank you, I say. He knows perfectly well I don't smoke. It's very simple, my objection. The real one. He lights up. This collection is incomplete. I'm surprised to see his hands are still shaking. This time he sees me notice them. I know he will make a mighty effort to bring them under control, just as he plans to bring my pictures under his control. As he puffs his cigar, he succeeds, at least with his own hands. The pictures, I know then and there, will be public record. Social anthropology of America, a contemporary metaphor of our time, pain, beauty, and power, not under his absolute control. But he has more to say, and as I always have with Arnold, I listen patiently. The reason this collection is incomplete, he says, gesturing with his Goliath of a cigar, is because there are no pictures of me on the set of The Villain, my movie with Kirk Douglas in 1979. There are no pictures of me in Stay Hungry. True. There are none of Conan the Barbarian in 1980, he adds quickly. I start to protest. Hold on, he draws on his cigar. Let me continue. There are no pictures of me in Hyannisport with the Kennedys, nor me with Jerry Ford or Jimmy Carter, and not one of me in the White House. If you were doing your job, George, he sweeps his cigar around his head at the picture of a wall of Ronald Reagan and the subject of this book. Glossy prints, all in color, of everyone he has just mentioned hang to the left and right, above and below. And there are many more of other grinning celebrities. You should have made sure, Arnold continues, to include them in this collection. This is my life. This is the way I see myself. This is Arnold. But Oak, my pictures are about light and form and character. I'm not interested in celebrities. I'm from New Hampshire, where the only celebrity is J.D. Salinger. Who? A writer. I thought so. I'm interested in you at your best, what you really do. I care about your character and what you did with your body and how talented you really are. You can be like Fred Astaire or Baryshnikov, really famous forever. No, he says resolutely. Yes, I reply with the conviction of someone who never gives up. Listen to me, George. I appreciate your interest in being a photographer, but all these pictures, he gestures at my boxes with an open hand, are the past. They have no meaning. I try to put bodybuilding behind me. I have to look forward now and do new things, bigger things. Oak, I say, protesting, you can't rewrite history. He puffs a cigar and takes it from his mouth. His hands are absolutely steady and his body rigid. I have to go now, he replies. Maria is waiting. I know you put a lot of work into these pictures. I think of that, but they are not right for me. He stretches lazily, controlling even his stiffness, breaking into his most charming smile. How is that Vietnam movie coming along? He asks, referring to a project I've been working on for several years. It deals with the true story of a Green Beret medic who was blown away by the war and cured himself later through his encounters with wild grizzlies in the mountains of Montana. The script is almost finished, I say. Well, when it's done and you're ready to direct it, call me. I can get you a studio deal. I know a lot of people at Universal. I tell them to do it for you, and they do it. Twins made $111 million for Universal. They listen carefully to what I say these days. You tell me. I call them. If it's a big action picture with bears eating everything in sight, they do it. Arnold stares at me in a thoughtful but extremely piercing way. There's a lot going on in his head behind those eyes. It is a moment of ambivalence about how he leads his life and what he knows I want to do with mine. We have done so much together and done it so well, but that is in the past. And we are men of very different sensibilities, held together only by this 10 years of old experience that Arnold at this moment really wants to forget. It is not Hollywood to honor friendship forever. But there cannot be any monkey business, George. It must be an action picture. None of this art bullshit. I open the palms of my hands toward him. Wouldn't you ever like in Time or Newsweek to get a good review of your acting or even with this book? I believe it'll get good reviews. Maybe the New York Press will cover the opening of the show and write well of it. Fuck them. I shake my head slowly and smile my most agreeable smile. It is exactly what Arnold knows I will do. Butler, my old friend, he says, you never have enough money for a taxi, but he pauses and puffs his cigar. Then he clenches it in the side of his mouth and speaks through his teeth. You are very smart. It's time for the big time. Don't waste yourself on these photographs. And remember, he stands up behind his desk and stretches again. Then he gives me the most piercing look of the afternoon. I always help you, he says, smiling. That's it. That's the end. This was 19... 1990 this book came out. So thank God George came out with it. It's a great book. So I encourage you guys to get it. There's a lot of great stuff in here too that I didn't read that we didn't have time. All right. So I hope you guys enjoyed this book, Arnold Schwarzenegger, A Portrait by George Butler. If, like I said, if you get a chance and you haven't gotten it yet, check it out. See if you can get it on eBay. See if you can get it on Amazon. And you will really, really enjoy it if you're an Arnold fan, for sure. All right, guys, that's it for the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Hopefully we will be back next week with a guest. I am still working on guests. I've been talking to Rick Wayne, so hopefully Rick will come back on the show this month, maybe October or maybe November, and we'll do another three-part interview with Rick as we did before. And then we got the Mr. Olympia coming up, so we'll probably talk about that as well with Jerry and try to get some other guests back on the show as well. All right, guys, have a great week. Enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.